So when we look at something like pipelines on fire, Iraq's production falling into the sand, what you're seeing is mission accomplished. Exxon is making $10 billion net profit clear every 3 months. No one has ever seen corporate profits like that since the Pharaohs.
That's Greg Palast, and this is Writer's Voice. Welcome to the show. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Later in the show, we'll talk with linguist Jeff Pullum, co-author of Far From the Matting Gerund and other dispatches from Language Log. But first, investigative journalist Greg Palast. Last week, Writer's Voice interviewed Peter Galbraith. He said that the Bush administration went to war in Iraq on an ideological agenda of bringing democracy to the Middle East, one that's failed miserably. But Greg Palast has another view. He says the Iraq war is part of a larger class war by the corporatocracy on people here at home as well as abroad. And he says he's found the documents to prove it. Palast writes for the BBC and Harper's Magazine. He's reported on irregularities in the 2000 and 2004 U.S. elections and in the recent Mexican election. He's also the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. Palast won the George Orwell Courage in Journalism Award for his BBC documentary, Bush Family Fortunes. I spoke to him in July about his new bestseller, Armed Madhouse, and other dispatches from the class war. The book uncovers a host of stories that I, for one, haven't seen anywhere else. I asked him how he manages to get such great material.
Some of the things, of course, I do, like Sam Spade stuff, like Where Hidden Wire is False Fronts. We have Agent Penny on our staff who speaks four languages fluently and has 12 accents that she can call on. We do that cool stuff, but some of it is real simple, like the fact that I found out that over 3.5 million ballots were cast and not counted in the 2004 election. All I have to do is, dig into the files, the public files of the Election Assistance Agency in Washington. And so a lot of investigative reporting is following that journalist Yogi Berra's dictum. It's amazing what you see when you look. That doesn't really happen in the United States. If it's not in a press release, if it's not coming out of a press conference, pretty much forget about it in terms of reading it.
And you're not new to investigation per se. I mean, even before you became a journalist, you did investigations.
Indeed. I was an investigator before I was an investigative reporter, and that's probably one of the big differences between my writings and other journalists, even investigative reporters, because I actually use those pretty sophisticated and, frankly, often quite expensive methods of getting the stuff. And I'll do things that most journalists won't do. I'll spend 2 years on a story. I'll keep the stuff cooking. And frankly, it's not that I'm a great genius in this. It's just that I have outlets at BBC TV. It's where they will allow me to do that.
Right. In other words, they do pay for that kind of stuff.
Yeah. I mean, it's a little narrow. I do have to. I don't get money from foundation or anything, but I do often ask readers, listen, chip in for. You like what you read? Chip in. And, of course, that's one thing. So we have to fund a lot of our investigations ourselves.
And you have a website, too.
Yep, we have a website which puts out a piece of our material. In fact, you can even see, like, for example, the reports I did from Venezuela, speaking with the president there, the theft of the Mexican election, my reports on the war in Iraq, et cetera. You can actually go to those BBC reports at www.gregpalast.com and see the usually about 10, 12-minute reports that I do. And that's another way we try to get kind of break through the electronic Berlin Wall. If I can't get on U.S. TV here, I'll just take the British TV and slap it onto the website.
In fact, I'm going to ask you about those Mexican elections a little bit later, but I really want to kind of get to the meat of your book. In the early pages of the book, you refer to Bush's photo op on the aircraft carrier.
Yes.
Where he said, mission accomplished.
Yes.
And you say that actually the war on terror ended the Tuesday before that.
Yes. Well, the great photo op with our president running around with the clips around his gonads so he looked like the first chimp in space there. I mean, that's the other thing, is that in British TV, I'm allowed to laugh when politicians make fools of themselves. Whereas Tom Brokaw had to sit there and go, the president of the United States has just jumped out of his jet fighter, Well, he could have been a bag of sugar. He was just, he was a passenger there, They could have put him in the cargo hold, So I find it ridiculous. But the main thing I found ridiculous was, the great leader of the war on terror, when in fact, what Al-Qaeda wanted, what Osama bin Laden wanted, was for the U.S. to get its troops out of Saudi Arabia. And, you know, 2 days before Bush lands on the deck of the aircraft carrier, he quietly whispers out, or Rumsfeld quietly whispers out, we're removing our troops from Saudi Arabia. In other words, he gave in to Osama bin Laden's demands. And that's why we, if you're wondering why we haven't been hit, because Osama said, pull your troops out of Saudi Arabia and I won't hit you again. We did it. In other words, basically he, you know, got down on his hands and knees and said, whatever you want, Osama, forget all the wanted dead or alive cowboy stuff.
Well, let me ask you something. I've been really curious for a while. I mean, it almost seems as if these guys, Osama and Bush, are really operating from the same page, that even in league with each other.
They're a tag team, useful to each other. I mean, it used to be, look, there was nothing more helpful for Lockheed and General Dynamics than the Soviet bear. And then when it turned out that the Soviet bear was just like a stuffed animal, it was pretty grim for the defense contractors under Bill Clinton, because you have to remember our defense budget fell by a third when Clinton said, gee, there's no Soviet Union out there. Why we have a Soviet war machine, anti-Soviet war machine? They don't exist. So we got a new guy out there, a bad man, so that we don't have a war even on Osama. We don't have a war on Al-Qaeda. We have a war on terror. Now, you have to understand, I used to have George Orwell's old column in The Observer, and I'm sure he'd love this. It's a war without end. We have no particular enemy, terror, a war on terror. Well, who's that? When do we win? When do we, you know, throw the confetti and kiss the nurse on the street? The truth is, there's a problem with the war on terror, that there's no terrorists in America. Mm-hmm. Let's remember, except for the September 11th attack, the prior attack was by some guy from Idaho, you know, in Oklahoma, right?
That's right. Timothy McVeigh.
Timothy McVeigh. By the way, Bill Clinton didn't erase 4 of our 10 Bill of Rights, you know, of our 10 amendments to the Constitution to shut down the killer white supremacist machine. He did it with law enforcement and lawsuits.
What do you mean? Shut down 4 of our 10 Bill of Rights?
Well, I mean, whatever happened to the Fifth Amendment, the First Amendment, basically under the Patriot Act, you are now the suspect. On September 11th, we were all victims. September 12th, we all became suspects. We're under surveillance. We have detention without charges, and the list goes on.
Do you mean Bush or Clinton?
Bush.
Okay.
But what I'm saying is Clinton did not erase amendments to the Constitution to get the terrorists, and because it wasn't a war on terror, it was a crime of terror, and he took care of it. But Bush has every reason to keep the war game going, and one of the, you know, like one of the things that some people think is a joke illustration in the book, but it's not. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, you get a lot of really serious investigative reporting, but some really bad jokes. So some people think it's a joke. I show a giant torpedo with 9 Marines stuffed inside.
Mm-hmm.
I call it Marines in a Tube. But that really came from the Department of Defense. We have a $2.5 billion submarine called the Virginia class. We have a half dozen of these things that our president has now ordered to be built. This is a war on terror machine. They say, now originally they were built to fight Soviet subs, but there's no more Soviet subs. So I called Lockheed and say, why are you still building these things? He said, well, this is for the war on terror. And at the time, by the way, it was the war on terror was in Afghanistan, right? I said, Afghanistan's landlocked, you know, but as we're heading, so well, you know, places like Iraq have little beaches, right? And the idea is you stick the Marines inside the torpedo and you shoot them onto the beach.
Right.
And that's $2.5 billion a pop. Now, you can't pull off stunts like that without someone saying, whoa, who's making the bucks on this one? But see, now you can say, we can put no price on defending America against terrorists. So we've got this kind of Marines in a tube for $2.5 billion each. Ground Zero has become a big profit center, and you can't have the profit center. Who is the number one celebrity spokesman? Osama bin Laden is Bush's spokesman for the war on terror. And every time the stock goes down on the war on terror, we get another video from the cave.
Well, that's exactly what I mean. It almost seems like they are in league with each other.
Yeah, they work each other very well. And by the way, Osama is a billionaire with his own Gulfstream and 2 dialysis machines. He doesn't live in a cave, just to correct that. But it's helpful to him, for his guys, who seems like a man of the people suffering with them when he hangs out, as far as I could tell, mostly at the Paris Hilton.
Wait a second. You're saying that Osama is not living in a cave?
No.
Do you know where Osama is?
No, but he's not living in a cave. He can't live in a cave. He has a kidney problem and he needs daily dialysis. You would die. He would not survive in a cave, okay? It's a con job. the last known place and probably where he's spending most of the time is Dubai.
You know, we talked about follow the money.
Yep.
And you say that, well, yes, Dorothy, it really is all about the oil.
Yeah.
So talk about Iraq, OPEC, and Saudi Arabia, talking about Osama bin Laden.
Well, in fact, it's all about, in the second, the first chapter is called Who's Afraid of Osama Wolf, which is about the fun and follies and the big profiteering and the war on terror. But the second chapter, Trillion Dollar Babies, is about Iraq and oil. It is about the oil. But what surprised me, in fact, as I point out, you know, you probably have a lot of conspiracy nuts among your listeners who think that George Bush had a secret plan, you know, to seize the oil fields of Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
And then we investigated. We found it's not true. He had two plans. We get them both. And we looked at them. And sure enough, the plan that's in place, which is Shakaroo, written by oil companies out of Houston, was not to get the oil, not to take Iraq's oil. I mean, this is where people got the beast wrong. Even I was, you know, I believed, you know, it was blood for oil.
Right.
Which is, of course, a very bad line, because most Americans think blood for oil is a bargain, right? But the
As long as it's someone else's blood.
Yeah, as long as it's someone else's blood, right? So what happened is that we went in not to get the oil, to make sure that there's not too much of it flooding the market. The big fear that that Saddam would withhold oil, because he's the one who kept trying to sell it. We're the ones that put the West and Bush put the lid on Saddam's sales at 2 million barrels a day under the oil for food program. Very little oil, very little food. They were trying to keep the oil off the market because it's the number one rule of the oil industry is the lower the supply, the higher the price. So when we look at something like pipelines on fire, Iraq's production falling into the sand, what you're seeing is mission accomplished. Oil, when Bill Clinton left office, was $20 a barrel, which is cheaper than peanut butter. Today, it's over $75 a barrel the day I'm talking to you, all right?
Mm-hmm.
That's mission accomplished. Exxon Mobil, which is the number one support, political campaign contributor to the Bush family after Enron, but obviously Enron's gone its own direction. Exxon is making $10 billion net profit clear every 3 months. No one has ever seen corporate profits like that since the Pharaohs. This is mission accomplished. This is what they had in mind, was control and suppression of Iraq's production. We didn't go in Iraq to bring you the oil so you can fill up, you know, your Hummer there cheaply. We went in to turn off the spigots.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with investigative reporter Greg Pallast about his new book, Armed Madhouse. Now, you say that there are actually two plans, and you were also able to get your hands on both. First, tell us what that second plan is, and tell us how you found them.
The second plan was to make sure that Iraq had a good relationship with OPEC. What that means is that OPEC, which is the oil cartel, the whole point of the oil cartel is to make sure that every nation has a limit on its production to keep the price up. By the way, that's against the law in America. Anyone who participates in the OPEC cartel has violated U.S. law. It's a crime. You go to jail. And yet, by the way, secretly, it was our own State Department working in coordination with James Baker's people, and he represents Exxon and the Saudi government, who were, in fact, coming up with a plan for Iraq to make sure that Iraq remains a good member of OPEC and limits its exports to 3 million barrels a day.
You mean it's illegal because it's price fixing?
Yeah. OPEC, you know, we talk about OPEC and we show these guys, you know, and somehow, you know, like our president runs around the Crawford Ranch in his golf cart with King Abdullah. King Abdullah is of Saudi Arabia is in fact the capo di capi of the world's biggest, most vicious, most costly price fixing cartel.
And
that is against the law, okay? And it is against the law for someone to participate. And when someone who participates in such a cartel arrives on the soil of the United States, and we have this with the vitamin cartel, we've had this with drug cartels, we've had this with several cartels, you arrive on the soil of the United States, you get busted and you go to jail.
Wasn't that why Standard Oil was broken up to begin with?
Yeah, exactly. But anyway, so Abdullah seems, I guess if you're, you know, a dictator in a bathrobe and a crown, you've got an exemption to the law. But the main thing is that we not only exempted OPEC from the normal laws against cartel conspiracy, we're actually abetting them and aiding them and making sure that Iraq would not in any way bust that cartel limit. quota limit. And that was the most interesting thing to me because, you know, like most people, I just thought, well, we went into Iraq to get the oil, but it's not. It's just the opposite. We went into Iraq, and we certainly are there to make sure that the oil remains controlled.
And controlled by whom?
Controlled, okay, it's a very interesting process. In fact, there is an objection by the oil companies to privatizing the oil, that is selling off the oil fields, something that the neocons wanted to do. Oil companies do not want to buy Iraq's fields. What they want to do is control it through something called production sharing agreements. That way the Iraqis can pretend that they actually own the fields, but in fact they're not in charge of the amount that's and how it's produced and when it's produced, et cetera, and who gets the profit. So there's these no-bid deals cut between the government and big oil, what they call in the inside documents, they call the IOCs, International Oil Companies, who would have PSA, production sharing agreements, which basically says, okay, in other words, like the country gets 15 or 20% of the oil and 80% goes to Exxon, Royal Dutch Shell, Total of France, etc. And so that's what these guys wanted, and that's what's in these documents. To do that, you have to have a state oil company, which then cuts deals, you know, headed by guys that the Houston team picks. In fact, so they did pick the Houston team did actually pick the ministers of oil for Iraq.
Now, you talk about two factions, though, in government, the no-brainers, who are not these guys, right?
Yeah.
And the witches brew, which are these guys. So tell us who the no-brainers are.
The no-brainers is kind of the a nickname for the neocons. A lot of people talk about the tremendous influence of the neocons, and it's not like they're without influence, but they're the guys that you see kind of publicly who love to go on Meet the Press and write op-eds and make speeches about bringing democracy to the Middle East. In fact, if you're inside the administration, you know these guys are pretty much wiped out, that they're kind of a joke. That's why Paul Wolfowitz was demoted out of the Defense Department and sent to the World Bank. Now, most of us on this planet would think being president of the World Bank is a pretty high post. Not in Bush world. That's considered like a baloney post, you know, where you lend money to Bangladeshi chicken farmers. Guys like Bolton, who is our UN representative, once again, that's not an important post in the administration. They don't think much of the UN, and you don't make any policy. You simply repeat the positions of the U.S. as you're just a mouthpiece. So all these neocons and people like Fife who were basically forced to resign and others pushed out. So the neocons kind of got wiped out in the administration, mainly because when they started messing with the oil issues.
How did they do that?
Okay, the neocons proposed that Iraq be remade into a free market miracle. It's going to be like Chile on the Tigris. And just like Chile, in fact, they told me, the neocons told me that their model was Pinochet of Chile, you know, the bloodthirsty dictator.
The guy who was just accused of having run a cocaine smuggling ring all those years.
Yeah, you got a problem with that? it's a free market, man. Get used to it. So anyway, so this free market model, which, you know, the little bit of blood, not too many elections, was the neocon model. And that was fine with the administration, certainly fine with Dick Cheney. But then they made one mistake. The neocons were not satisfied with privatizing, that is, selling off the state banks of Iraq, their bakeries, their bridges, their water systems, you name it. They arranged to sell, basically to shoplift the entire country.
Mm-hmm.
And they call that creating a free market. Well, it's free to the guys who are picking it up.
And I believe only non-Iraqi companies were even allowed to buy them, isn't that
well,
right?
Well, not that they were barred, but what are they going to use? The Iraqis only had Saddam Diners. They had monopoly money. And Americans had dollars, and the French have euros, and the Russians have rubles, which are very strong because it's backed by oil, right? Iraqis had no money to bid for their own nation's assets. If you think about that. I mean, basically, we put everything up for sale, and the country was in a depression. No one had any money. You know, ironically, you know, what really made out was a few Baathists who had salted away cash in Switzerland and came back and bought up their own nation that they'd previously looted. So those are the only Iraqis that got anywhere, were the old Baathists. They really made out quite well. But when the neocons said, well, let's then now sell off the oil fields, then big oil stepped in and started breaking political bones in Washington. That's when Wolfowitz got fired. That's when Bolton got fired. That's when all these guys got dumped over the side because they wouldn't get off this idea of selling off the Iraq oil fields. And the reason they had for selling off Iraq oil fields was exactly what the oil companies didn't like. They said, if we sell off the oil fields, there'll be all these little operators will compete against each other. They'll ramp up the production in Iraq to 6 million barrels a day, which it could easily produce, and then we'll crush the oil market. Oil will drop from $75 to $15 a barrel, and Saudi Arabia will fall to its knees and fall apart, because these guys hated Saudi Arabia. The problem is that Saudi Arabia, being the head of the oil cartel, is real, real close to big oil. Like I say, James Baker, the former Secretary of State, who has an office in the White House, which is, you know, just like astonishing. He represents ExxonMobil and the Saudi Arabian government, and that guy has an office in the White House. Cheney doesn't have an office in the White House. James Baker has an office in the White House. So if you want to know the influence of Exxon and the Saudis, James Baker has the office in the White House.
Wow. That symbolism is pretty rich. But you know, talking about Cheney, so are you really saying that it's not Cheney isn't the one who's president? It's actually
Cheney. Well, yeah, the two of them kind of share duties. Baker is one of those grand voices who steps in to make grand policy pronouncements on behalf of the establishment. Cheney runs things. I'm told, you know, the most interesting thing about my investigations of the war in Iraq in the book, you know, there's a lot of other subjects, you know, mm-hmm. but the war in Iraq investigation is very interesting because in reviewing 4 years of discussions, memoranda, documents, meetings, etc., it's Cheney this and Cheney saw that, and then they had that meeting with James Baker and Cheney and the Council of Foreign Relations and Exxon Oil and da-da, and Wolfowitz said this, and not once did I see George Bush's name on anything.
Wow.
The President of the United States had not one thing to do with our Iraq policy. He wasn't in the discussion. He wasn't told what was going on. He wasn't in this war between the neocons and the big oil about selling off Iraq's oil fields. That's not exactly a minor issue. There was no discussion about with the president about who would be in charge of the occupation of Iraq when Jay Garner was fired as our viceroy. That was done by Don Rumsfeld. And behind it all, day to day, when the factions could not decide, the judge was always the man in the bunker, Dick Cheney. Over and over again, they said energy policy and every other policy in the United States is set by one man, Dick Cheney.
That's Greg Palast talking about his book, Armed Madhouse. You know, it's really terrifying, and actually you have him as being part of both factions.
Yes.
How does he do that? How does he play
Why do you think
both
sides? Why do you think Dick Cheney's president? Because he knows how to, he leads all the factions. I mean, the guy is, you know, no foolish player here. Mm-hmm. He's a guy who signed the PNAC document, which is the document for a new American century, the project for a new American century, which is like the neocon manifesto. On the other hand, he is an executive out of the oil industry in Halliburton, and each faction claims him as their leader.
They claim him, or do you feel
No, they really claim him.
He is.
But he is, in a way, because he's the final decision maker when all things have to be weighed out.
Well, you know, your book really did give me a new perspective, not only on Iraq in reading it, and it is brilliant, and I urge every listener to get this book.
And Armed Madhouse, it's called, by the way.
That's right. An Armed Madhouse, Who's Afraid of Osama Wolf, China Floats, Bush Sinks, The Scheme to Steal 08, No Child's Behind Left, and Other Dispatches from the Front Lines of the Class War.
And got through that without a mistake, too. I really appreciate that. It's like the longest title in published history.
It is, and that No Child's Behind Left, I think, is the toughest part of it.
It is. Why am I laughing about it? It's really quite grim, but that's exactly, you know, our president's educational program. I had to translate the real meaning of his words. But I think that you can't really split theft of the elections, the fake war on terror, the profiteering there, the oil fields of Iraq from educational policy. It's all, these are all, by the way, in my view, the reason why I call our madhouse, you know, the short subtitle is Other Dispatches from the Front Lines of the Class War,
right,
is that these are ways in which the few, the haves, or as the president says, the haves and have-mores control the people who should have. And they take away your vote. They take away your hope by taking away your kids' education. They take away, you know, they take away your life in Iraq. So That's what it's about. These are all very, all these investigations are really aimed at one thing. It's aiming at the privileged and the powerful and the few.
And it is that class war. I think that's what's so key. And so I wanted, in the time that we have left, because I would love to spend another 30 minutes with you, but I know you have to go on. I want to ask you some questions, kind of using that analysis to some more recent, very recent events. Mm-hmm. I heard you talk the other day on Democracy Now! About the Mexican election. Is there any relevance of this oil man politique to what's happened in Mexico?
Absolutely. It's about the oil in Mexico. Saudi Arabia is not the big source of our imported oil in America. Our two biggest suppliers are Canada and Mexico. And there's a huge battle over who should control Mexico and Mexican oil. Pemex, all oil in Mexico by law, has to be developed and pulled up by Pemex, the national oil company. But the conservative ruling party, which basically just shoplifted the last election here.
Like they did ours.
Yeah, called the guy Felipe Calderon, who was, by the way, oil minister. This guy believes that the U.S. oil company should have a piece of the action in Mexico. And his populist opponent, who really won the vote, his name is López Obrador. This guy said, I'm not going to cut off the United States. It's our big customer. You know, I want to sell oil to the United States. I want to expand, but we can do it ourselves. We really don't need U.S. oil companies. Because we saw what happened in Argentina. Argentina was dead busted. Why? It sold off its state oil company. If it had kept its state oil company, it would be rolling in dough. And López Obrador said, we're not going to make that mistake. We're going to pretty much follow kind of the pattern of Venezuela, which is we keep the money. If we give you the oil, we keep the money. That's the deal. And that's what the election was about. It was about the oil.
Now,
and they had to steal it in the same exact way that they stole the U.S. elections in 2000, 2004. It was the same, even the same players.
And yet, they're not taking it lying down the way the Democrats did.
No. There's a difference. You know, I mean, Al Beta Dog Gore, you know. for those who don't know Greg Palast, I'm the guy that broke that story about how, for BBC TV, about how just before the election of 2000, Jeb Bush and Catherine Harris knocked off tens of thousands of voters off the voter rolls and accused them of being criminals who can't vote. In fact, they were just people guilty of voting while black.
Right.
That type of scrubbing and not, and then in the Ohio 2004, as I point out in my book, the game was don't count the votes, prevent votes from being counted. They didn't, you know, so the same games are played in Mexico as are played in the United States.
And they use some of the same
use some of the same consultants and players. They use, like, for example, George Bush is part of the War on Terror. This is where our War on Terror money is going. I get this inside contract, War on Terror, counterterrorism and intelligence. You know, look, I think we ought to get intelligence on the bad guys. I'm not against that. I have no problem with that. But what is the contract for? Is it about going after this Saudi Arabian hijackers? Well, you can't touch Saudi Arabia. That's, you know, King Abdullah. But the counterterrorism intelligence gathering was to basically steal the voter lists of Venezuela and Mexico. I mean, it's just unbelievable. They're stealing the voter lists of Venezuela and Mexico under the contracts for War on Terror. So you can't question it, because if you question why are we doing that, why are we stealing voter lists of Latin American countries? Because if you ask that question, then you're questioning the War on Terror. And, of course, they don't. It's not like they tell you this stuff. We had to go get the contracts to find out that's what they were doing. But the cover of the contract, which they were resistant to even showing us, just says counterterrorism. You know, well, that sounds good. Oh, counterterrorism. I'm countering the terrorists myself every day. But it was not about countering terrorism. It's not a war on terror. It's a war on democracy.
In the time that we have left, two things. One is that you don't just talk about the war on democracy in great detail, which is important, and give us important information, but you also tell us of some things, some ways in which people in the world are actually doing things differently. For example, in India, in Kerala, that there is another model that's being followed.
That's right. You don't need the free market uberalis Thomas Friedman baloney. And if you have students or others who are stuck with reading the flat earth or olive tree burn the olive tree, sell the Lexus, whatever Friedman's written there. If you've been tortured by that, this is the response, which is that the great nation of India, following the free market model, before the free market party came in, the BJP, industrial wages in India were 25 cents an hour. pretty grim. Today, after the free market explosion and expansion of the economy, wages are 23 cents an hour. They've fallen. And that's the free market miracle. But there's dissenters, and like the southern tip of India is the state of Kerala, and that state has kind of rejected the free market model, and they're doing very, very well based on a kind of communalist, quasi kind of social welfare model, educating everyone. They have higher literacy than the United States. And so it's a different model. And in fact, just so you won't forget it, and so you can take a break to have something to eat during the book, I include a recipe for fish curry.
Yeah, that's a great one.
It's
Did you try the recipe?
It's
no,
great.
I'm going to.
It's excellent. It really is.
Well, Greg Palast, thanks again for coming on to Writer's Voice. The book is Armed Madhouse and Other Dispatches from the Front Lines of the Class War.
It's been super fun.
You're listening to Writer's Voice on Valley Free Radio, 103.3 FM in Northampton. Stay tuned for our interview with linguist Jeff Pullum after the break.
So it seems, at least to me, the water's not as blue as I remember. There's beautiful days, my fair weather friends do stay away while they're on their escapades. It makes me wonder how and why things got this far. I'll take a plane, a bus, a car.
I'll take a jet plane, or I'll take a boat jet.
The song is titled Water Under the Bridge from an unreleased album by Jonah Friedman and Michael DiLiberto called Monopoly. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. Is it really wrong to end a sentence with a preposition? Well, that's something writers like to argue about. Or is it about which writers like to argue? Next, we ponder these questions and other grammatical conundrums with Jeff Pullum. He teaches linguistics at the University of California at Santa Cruz. Pullum co-authored the book Far From the Matting Gerund with Mark Lieberman, who maintains the collaborative weblog Language Log. It's dedicated to the use of language in the media and popular culture, and was featured recently in the New York Times as one of the most popular linguistics blogs on the web. Their book compiles posts to Language Log. And Daisy Mathias, my host on WMUA, and I started our interview by asking Pullum about one of his favorite posts. you have a wonderful thing about they as a reference to a singular subject. I think this comes from a graffiti of somebody who was a proponent of Arnold Schwarzenegger for president. I wonder
yes,
if you could talk about
that. Yes, that is one of my favorite examples, gathered in strange places. A student found this on a wall. Somebody had written, "Vote Arnold for Prez," and another person had scrawled something obscene about Arnold Schwarzenegger below that and added that the first writer was ignorant. And a third person had come along to adjudicate this graffiti dispute and wrote on the wall below "Vote Arnold for Prez" and the obscene insult, "This person is not ignorant. They are a prophet. The machines will rule us." And the example is so beautiful. The key thing there is they are a prophet. It shows you what's happening with they. It's being used as a pronoun of singular number but indefinite gender, neither masculine nor feminine, in cases where the actual identity of the person is not known. Now, what was so cute about this was that the examples were, of course, on the wall of a stall in a men's toilet. So we actually do know the gender, but that's not good enough. The reason they was used is because in colloquial English today, you use it when you don't have identity of the referent, so you don't have a sort of strict basis for being absolutely sure they have a particular sex. You never use singular they with names as antecedents. It doesn't matter if you've heard about someone called Chris and you don't know whether that's a Christine or a Christopher. If Chris appears to have left an umbrella behind, you can't say Chris seems to have forgotten their umbrella. Mm-hmm. Because you're using a name to refer to an actual person and you know the person has sex there. But when you don't know anything about who this might have been, that's when singular they is appropriate. That's why you get phrases like, "Anyone who thinks they might be interested should see me afterwards." And it's treated in the usage books as just a mistake. All that Strunk and White say in the Elements of Style is, don't do this. They just say, if it's something like each one has their own, don't do this. That's an absurd thing to say, because the language has its own mode of operation. You can't just legislate these things. English actually has evolved to a different stage where there is a third-person singular pronoun that's neither masculine nor feminine.
Well, and I think it avoids that very awkward he/she.
And in fact, I was thinking...
Yes, anyone who finds he or she thinks that he or she might do himself or herself a favor by making sure that he or she uses it in his or her prose is an idiot.
And isn't this a product of the women's liberation movement? Because back in the days that I remember, you didn't need to have they, because anybody who was the indeterminate pronoun was always he.
Yes, but Rodney Huddleston and I, in the Cambridge Grammar of the English Language, have an argument that cannot be right. If it were true that he could refer to a person of either sex, then it should be just fine to say things like, "Was it your mom or your dad who broke his leg while he was on vacation?"
Mm.
But that sounds bizarre, because the truth is that he is for males. And if you say he, it's dad. That just can't be explained if you assume that he has got a second meaning where it means he or she. It doesn't.
Well, that's true, but they're also... It seems to me then that they is being used instead of that, because I know I find myself, I don't want to say he or she. That sounds so incredibly awkward, but I'm be damned if I'm going to say he when I don't know the sex of somebody.
Right.
So I will use they.
Right, and the language licenses you to do that. It's quite clear. This is very common. It's increasing in frequency, especially among young people. And what's more, it's got a long history. It's actually attested over about 600 or 700 years in the language, and all of the finest writers have used it. It's always been there. But around the 19th century, usage specialists started trying to legislate a whole lot of stuff that didn't need legislating, and this is one of the things they picked on because they thought they saw some kind of logical error, and they started saying, don't do this. The linguist's attitude here is, let's look at the language and see what it's like. Let's not draw up legislation to try and alter it, because we're not so empowered.
Well, that's very English attitude.
Because the Spanish and French speakers have academies that do legislate language. Of course, it doesn't work. The one word from the French Academy and French people in the streets of Paris say exactly what they like. Yeah. It doesn't actually work, but there is technically a government-sponsored institution called the French Academy, which draws up rules and makes decisions on whether certain words are permitted and so on, and government documents have to obey those. Well, people in the streets don't obey them. They just decide for themselves how French is going to be, and it's the consensus among them that determines what you should really be teaching in a French class. You shouldn't listen to the French Academy. What's interesting about English is it's never had an academy. Nobody has ever set up an institution with government backing that is supposed to expound English the way it really is. There are books that try to take that on, and people do believe them. It's funny how we are drawn to authority even when it's spurious. But English doesn't have that built into the legal system, as it were.
Tell us, what is the connection between linguistics and logic? Because as I was reading your book, I began to get an understanding, a richer understanding of what linguistics is, having never studied linguistics. So talk about that connection between linguistics, or as you call it at one point in the book, elementary reasoning.
Well, there is a link between linguistics and logic, both at a technical level, because formal logic is used in formalizing claims within linguistics, but much more generally and much more simply, there are connections between how the language is structured and how you can make a particular point unambiguously so that reasoning from it can be done clearly without errors. But the two subjects are quite distinct. In everyday life, our lives are so rich that we have to use systems that provide a fantastic variety of different ways of being deployed, and often use words that are ambiguous and phrases that can bear more than one meaning. Lots of terms that are vague, but in the context will do and will be cleared up. So it's almost impossible to base a precise study of reasoning on a natural language like English. And always a mistake to look in English for clear signs of it having been designed by a logician. It evolved over 600 or 700 years of ordinary people wrangling and haggling and gossiping every day until a consensus settled down about how we would say things.
And yet you do seem to use reasoning to decide controversies or to kind of tease out what you think might be the correct approach in something.
But we're using reasoning as a standard tool of thinking precisely about anything on the basis of evidence. Take the case of singular they, then, because it's a perfectly reasonable example of the sort of thing that linguists have to do. One first looks at evidence of how the language has been used, that people really do use they in published books of hundreds of years ago that are regarded as jewels of literature, with the antecedent to which the pronoun refers back being something like everyone. Shakespeare did. Now, from that, we know that there are cases of they that have singular antecedents. But which singular antecedents? And what does that imply for how we should describe they? You use reasoning to work out what the right description should be, but on the basis of evidence about how the language actually is used.
And that gets us to how language changes. Verbs seem to be getting more regular. We're losing the irregular verbs as language changes. It looks to me, as we look at English, that we keep simplifying things.
Well, a lot of simplification goes on, but then when something gets simplified away that actually had a point to it, something else will be pushed in, perhaps in a different part of the grammar, to help out keeping things straight.
For example,
and that will introduce complications. So you get recomplication in other areas, even as you get simplification in some. The classic case here in the history of English is endings dropping away, so that for learning modern English, there's far less to learn about endings of verbs than there used to be for Old English. But as a result, the word order is much stricter in modern English than it was in Old English.
You
must be careful to get your verbs and your nouns in the right places, or you'll have made a mistake in what you've communicated.
You know, I'd like to go back to the point you made about Strunk and White, if I may turn the subject back to some of the specific grammatical issues that you take up. And by way of introduction into that, there's a marvelous poem that you reproduced by Brecht, and then you followed up with a suggested addition to that.
Would that be those who take the adjectives from the table?
Yes.
Yes, the poem by Bertolt Brecht that I quote says, "Those who take the meat from the table teach contentment. Those for whom the taxes are destined demand sacrifice. Those who eat their fill speak to the hungry of wonderful times to come. Those who lead the country into the abyss call ruling too difficult for ordinary men." It's a wonderful, scathing attack on political authority, and I was irresistibly reminded of it in reading some of the things that prescriptive usage experts say about use of adjectives. Strunk and White in the Elements of Style say quite straightforwardly, write with nouns and verbs, not with adjectives and adverbs. And you look at the next sentence after that, and they use two adjectives right there. In fact, it's an indecisive disjunction of adjectives, weak or inaccurate. I think they say something like, the adjective has not been designed that can pull a weak or inaccurate noun out of a tight spot. That's from memory.
In fact, the point is,
when they decide it's all right for them to use adjectives, they'll do it.
Well, I thought what was so wonderful is that you follow up the Brecht poem with precisely the sentence, "Those who lard their prose with juicy, slobbering adjectival modifiers," he might have added, "write stupid little books like the Elements of Style." So tell us why it's okay to use adverbs and adjectives. I mean, when I write, I try to follow that Strunk and White thing and, you know, take out every what I think is unnecessary adverb or adjective. And sometimes I feel like, oh, what a pity it is that I have to take that out. So tell us why we don't have to feel so guilty to have
because
them in.
All fine writing contains adjectives and adverbs at some frequency. It's often around 8%. It'll be a little bit higher among academics and people like Strunk and White who write about language, and perhaps a little bit lower in some very elementary, fast-paced description of events or comic book dialogue or something, but it never falls to zero. And the strange thing is that people have even believed you could write or speak without adjectives. No less a person than Alastair Cook, the wonderful broadcaster who spent about 50 years doing little quarter of an hour letters from America for the BBC, actually said that he used to write his pieces out and then work away at them, cutting out all the adjectives and adverbs. Does anybody really believe that Alastair Cook could speak on the radio a quarter of an hour every week for 50 years without adjectives or adverbs? Not if you're a linguist, because we know which the adjectives and adverbs are. I can only assume that people have the haziest grasp of what might be an adjective, and they have no idea whether they've used one or not. That's the only explanation I can think of for people's blind acceptance of nonsense, like what Strunk and White say about how you shouldn't use adjectives and adverbs. It's absolutely insane. And incidentally, I can't even say that without using the adjective insane, can I?
You're listening to an interview that Daisy and I did with Jeff Pullum, co-author of the book Far From the Madding Gerund. it seems like the pendulum swing away from the Victorian over-descriptiveness towards a Hemingway-esque sort of spareness.
Well, the pendulum hasn't swung nearly far enough, as far as I'm concerned. People are still paying far too much attention to this stuff. And I think what's particularly annoying about the Strunk and White prescriptivism is that sometimes it's just arbitrary authoritarianism. Don't use they with a singular antecedent like everyone. Why? Because we say so. And other times it's absolutely anodyne, almost pointless platitudes like be clear. Now, whoever wanted not to be clear? Omit needless words. What on earth is that meant to mean? How do you know when a word is needless? You've got to know the answer before you know whether you can omit it or not.
I can understand it, though, because, for example, I do think of those things when I write. You know, I go back, I read something aloud, and I often find, you know, by reading aloud, I find needless words. I find words that kind of act as, you know, boulders in the free-flowing stream of the language. And in fact, you yourself were a professional musician at one time, and I wondered how much of your own ear training goes into your judgments about grammar, because I know I depend a lot on the way something sounds, and it sounds when I read your book that you might also.
Well, I'm not denying that there is such a thing as constructing phrases that have a nice rhythm to them, in addition to hitting the meaning point right on the head. I'm not denying that there's good writing and there's bad writing and that you should go over your prose, you see. I'm not saying that I couldn't go through a 300-word piece and cut out the bits and pieces of blather and unneeded nonsense and chop it down to 200 words. It's a very interesting fact that you can usually reduce any piece to two-thirds of the size and it'll say the same thing and you won't notice anything missing after you read it.
Could we call that Pullum's Law?
If you want. I'm just arguing against completely false, simplistic ideas, like that the thing to do is get rid of the adjectives and adverb. The phrase from Strunk and White, be clear, has two words, and the second of them is an adjective.
Well, I have another question now, back to the grammar, back to the brass tacks here.
Yeah.
As having been someone who often tries to twist my way around the injunction against using a preposition to end a sentence, and by the way, the voice of my strict eighth grade teacher, Mrs. Convery, is always ringing in my ears. She was actually a wonderful teacher, very strict, and I can remember her saying, do not ever end a sentence with a preposition. So talk about that it's okay to end a sentence with a preposition.
It is not only ridiculously false to say that you shouldn't do this and good writers don't. We actually know the year in which a single person invented this rule out of absolutely nothing. John Dryden, the essayist. And I believe the year was 1672, if memory serves. It's in the book. Dryden just decided that he didn't like some of the prose by his hated rival Ben Jonson, who was very famous at the time, more famous than Shakespeare. And he just noticed the phrase, the souls that those bodies were frighted from, with from at the end, perfectly grammatical relative clause there. And he decided to write that this is bad, you shouldn't do this. He published that essay, and then he noticed that his own works had numerous cases of him doing it. So over the next few years, he quietly changed those bits and released new editions. What a hypocrite. You can see examples of prepositions at ends of clauses in literature 600 years old. And in colloquial English, it has been absolutely the standard way to speak all the time. The frequency at the moment of questions like, to whom were you speaking, in conversation is almost zero. The frequency of expressions like, who were you speaking to, is almost 100% of the possible cases.
What about the word whom?
Well, it's not dead, but one has to look forward expectantly to its death when one sees evidence that people don't know how to use it. There's a wonderful example on one language log post of some students carrying a big sign which has a whom that clearly should be who painted in letters 6 inches high on a bedsheet. It's not completely dead. What you do find quite often is that immediately after a preposition in a relative clause, you will find this. People are saying, anyone to whom this seems a bit mysterious, I can only say that I agree with them. The to whom there is fairly robustly still embedded in the language. But the frequency of whom as the first word of a sentence, as in, whom did you see at the party, is virtually zero in conversation now, and not at all common in writing. Who did you see, in other words, is the way we're saying it. The word is on its way out.
Well, let's talk about something that is also falling out of favor, and I have to say, I think it's regrettable, and that is the notorious use of lay versus lie. I think there is a reason for this. You seem to think so, too, that is, there is a reason to retain it. I wonder if you could talk about that.
Well, I think the main point that I make in the article in the book, Lie or Lay, Some Disastrously Unhelpful Guidance, is that, I intended this to be humorous, and the main point that comes out of it to me is this. The grammatical system of English here is so complicated and confusing that the remarkable thing is that anybody ever gets any of this right. We're talking about three quite different verbs. Lie in the sense of tell untruths, which is fully regular. Lie in the sense of be recumbent in posture, as in lying down. And lay, which means to deposit or place in a recumbent posture. And they sort of overlap in the forms of the paradigm that they have. For example, the verb that has the meaning to be recumbent has as its preterite the simple past tense lay, which is the present tense of the transitive verb meaning deposit. And the verb that means be recumbent has the past participle lain, but lay has laid, and the other lie has lied. And as you look through, it's just astonishing that anyone ever gets this right. The fact is that I chose to look for lay and lie in a whole lot of things like popular song lines, lay, lady, lay, or when I lay my burden down, lay down, little doggies, lay it soft against my skin. I looked through a whole bunch of examples and found it was sort of like 50% were correct according to the original system and 50% were incorrect. I don't have anything much to say about what we ought to do, because my inclination as a linguist is to watch the situation develop and see what it tells us about the human ability to use language.
That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Please join us next week for another in our series, Election 2006. We'll talk with Spencer Overton about his book, Stealing Democracy, The New Politics of Voter Suppression. We'll also hear an interview by guest host Jody Schneider with sci-fi writer Chris Moriarty. To learn more about Writer's Voice, visit our website at writersvoice.net. You can hear excerpts from our interviews and find out about upcoming shows and featured authors. So join us again next week for Writer's Voice. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon, and stay tuned for Marla Beebe and Self-Defense.